Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's podcast time, and as you can tell, Chris Smith is not with us tonight, so I have to introduce the show, but I am so happy that we have three fantastic guests. You got to start with the top, Ted Ryan from Ford Archives. He is with us today to talk about a very, very cool thing that Ford is launching. Technically, as we are discussing, it is still embargoed, but when you hear this episode, it'll be up and running. Seth Miersma, Motor One US editor-in-chief is with us, and Brett T. Evans, MotorOne.com editor, is also with us. So thank you so, so much, guys. I'm not used to introducing the show. This is usually Smith's job. So where well do I go from here?
Good job. We'll start by quashing the rumors that Chris Smith has been fired for his bad taste in music and or energy drinks. That
most things in general, just bad taste. Period.
Yeah, that's Chris. Right. Chris will be back. We couldn't do the site without him. Basically,
exactly.
And I'll start by saying thank you. Thank you for having me on tonight. I get to talk about a passion project. So let's roll.
Yeah, let's do it. So, Ted, tell us about this passion project. I am going to pull up the site right now and share it with the people. But it is FordHeritageVault.com. It is launching on Thursday, June 16th. Anyone who's watching this, you'll be seeing it on Friday, June 17th. But this is one of the coolest things to come out in terms of classic cars in a while. And that is because if you like old Fords, this is something you have to see. So, Ted, please tell us about it.
Okay, this is a passion project of the Ford Archives. We have an internal database that you guys can't see, but we can see it, and our media team can see it. It has 100,000-plus digitized assets. COVID was and is horrible, but in our case, for our archives, it enabled us to work from home and catalog. So we, at the very beginning of COVID, had just finished scanning 200,000 assets, and we began to catalog them. And our internal site had 100,000 assets, and it's available internally for us. 2 years ago, I went to Jim Farley, and I said, our charge is to modernize and be transparent, within Ford. That's our purpose. So I said, we can do this by making these materials that are behind the firewall. They're behind, you have to email somebody at Ford to get them. And y'all in the media can do it because you have our email address, but the general public can't do it. So we decided to launch this public facing site, FordHeritageVault.com, and 2 years of effort to get it going. So what is in there at the launch? Number one is 2,500 to 3,000 photos, essentially a curated collection of every Ford automobile that we have. There's some holes in there. I don't think I have a 58 Lincoln Capri in there. And there's a few other gaps that we're going to have to go back and fill. But essentially, anybody that wants a U.S.-built Ford between 1903 and 2003, those images are there. But then as the screen is rolling, you'll see we had put brochures in there. And this is what we felt was going to be the real meat of the collection, because anybody can Google a Mustang picture and you can probably get it. But can you get a 1948 F1 brochure? Probably not. Well, I've got them. I've got them all in the archive. So we spent a lot of money and we digitized them and we made them OCR accessible. And we have been working for the past year and a half to make them accessible to the public so that the public can be able to see, view, and download for free anything in our archives. And free being the key point. There's no charge, there's no firewall, there's no nothing. If you can find it in there, as long as you're not putting it on a t-shirt or a coffee mug where licensing would have an issue, it's there for you. So what? Just behind the scenes or back school pool, I challenged the team. I said, so let's get it a site so that it can be robust enough that a high school kid doing a paper on the Mustang can find a picture and a brochure that they need to finish their report for school, or a media member can find what they're looking to on deadline, find a picture to include in a story, or that a Thunderbird enthusiast could find to fill that one brochure they don't already have in their collection. And I think that we've hit the mark with this. He's going to click open now, and it's going to take a second because these brochures are scanned at 600 DPI, and it takes him a minute to download. But when they when they're downloaded, you can blow them up as tight as you want because we wanted everybody to be able to see all the details, see the engine specification, see the color, see everything that there is to see in that brochure, just like you were holding it in your hand. And so 3,500 brochures, 2,500 to 3,000 images. We just added another 300 today. We found out, my team found out we left out 8 model years of Mustang. Well, you can't launch a site with 8 model years of Mustang not in there. So we added a bunch in at the last second to get them in there. And it's been a labor of love. I described it, you know, I've got a team of 6 archivists who work for me. We're information managers. We love information. We love to share it. We love to share the stuff that we have because we've got this amazing collection, and let's do it the best that we can. So I think that we've made a great first step in finding a way to share information, documents, photos with the general public.
So Ted, I mean, that first number, obviously you're talking about this sort of being ongoing, but 2,500 brochure or 3,500 brochures and all those images, there's still an element of curation to that, right? You're still starting from hundreds of thousands. Did you just have like a massive checklist of every model that Ford has ever produced and sort of making sure that you hit everything on that list? Or what was the process of selection there, that first round of curation?
Very good question. We actually do have a master list of every Ford automobile produced in North America and Canada. It gets sketchier as you get overseas and the names change and models and everything. But the second part of the curation is to make sure it's rights free because we wanted this to be a public site. We wanted everything to be downloadable. So it took a year of negotiating with legal to make sure the brochures could be downloaded. You know, there was some hesitancy. Oh, this is photography and do we have rights? And we worked with them and we convinced them that it was produced as a sales aid initially and Ford did have rights. So it's available now. But you'll notice if you're looking for pictures of noted celebrities and their vehicles, you're not going to find it in the site. I just don't have the talent rights to be able to give you Elvis and his Mark II. So there's a heavy level of curation involved with this. Mm-hmm. So the F1 downloaded?
It did. I apologize. It was a StreamYard thing. I was looking at it, but unfortunately our audience was not immediately looking at it. So, but it's all here now and you can see
this is what we did. This is why we did it. So that F-Series car fans in general can know everything about that particular model that we know. When you write me, I go to the brochure and I start flipping through the pages and I answer back But now we've made it available and there's no firewall. There's no speed bump in between you and the data.
And I just want to point out something. This is just an image I pulled up. We were talking about Ford F1, but you know, you look at other sources, you know, you try to like look things up on Wikipedia or there are various sites out there that I'm not necessarily going to name, but here you can find, here is the brochure for, I believe this is the 1950 F1. And here are the gear ratios for the 1950 F1. And for a lot of people, you know, maybe they don't care. But say you're in the F1 club and you do care about that. And I think what's really interesting and what's special about this is, like you mentioned, if you belong to the F1 club or something like that, this information is now available to you and you can share it with people and you can know it's accurate or you can at least know that that's what Ford said. So that's what they were saying at the time and you can go from there. And it's just really, really special in my opinion. Seth and I were kind of talking about, go ahead, Brett.
I was just saying, it also kind of shows you how far we've come because the steering ratio on that truck down there was 18 point something to one. Like you're cranking the wheel like 8 times to get all the way. And
18.2 to one.
Wow. Yeah, that's double what you get in a car nowadays. So really just kind of shows you how far we've come. It's really such
Let me scroll up to the top and I'll tell you what year this is. F1. I thought it was 50. I thought it was, anyway.
Bonus baby is 48 or 49. I love the fact you said Wikipedia because in one of our early
49. Okay.
49. Yeah. In one of our early conversations, we described this as the Wikipedia buster. Now, Wikipedia is what, 80% correct or 82 or whatever percentage you believe. But we're putting the raw material out there, and now people can make their own decision. And, right. You know, it will, I, a dream of mine would be in 3 years to click on a Wikipedia article on the F1 and see this brochure as a footnote back to right. my site so people can download the real thing.
Mm-hmm. And for anyone not watching on YouTube, we are looking at torque curves right now for the available engine in the 49 F1 that was either a 226 cubic inch inline six or a 239 flathead V8. And like, that's just information that is very, very hard to find. And I say that as someone who has been writing about cars for over a decade, that for older vehicles, that's just not stuff that you find. And here it is. And you can look it up as easily as I can.
Yeah, immediately, you guys, I think about, so Wikipedia obviously is a great comp, right? And but a lot of this stuff lived, like, there are versions of a little bit of this that exist all over the internet on forums, right? Or sure. on weird websites and car clubs and things like that. The idea that you have one centralized place that's sort of the site of record for all of these things that really is going back to the original source material, like, it's incredibly important, not only for the enthusiast community, but for us, you know, Ted, you sort of let off of this, but for us as journalists too, to be able to go there and say, like, no, we can say definitively, at least this was the answer that the lawyers agreed to in 1949, right? Like,
exactly.
So
I love that phrasing.
Well, listen, and we can get into this too. I have a little bit of a history before coming back to Motor One. I was at an agency in Detroit working on a very large and well-known competitor to Ford, working on some of their stuff. And so I had access to their archives and was doing a lot of times to work on magazine stories with their archivists and going through some of this stuff and having the same sort of feelings of enthusiasm and just like, I can't believe this exists, especially when you're looking at it in physical form. You know, when you're there in the archives, that's really fun too. So I know the pain of, or I feel like I understand the pain of having to bring something from a concept forum to publishing it in 2020-ish. And I imagine it was very difficult in the 70s and 60s and yeah. 50s as well. So
I'm the one that has to sign the affidavits on any advertising claim. So I'm very versed in the what lawyers agree on any claim going out. It's interesting how the auto industry works like that.
Yeah.
But it's a way to take the filter off. I mean, if you think about it like that, which is, you know, keep in mind, we're not marketers. I run a department of six full-time archivists and six part-time archivists. And we're catalogers and information specialists and or storytellers. We combine all three hats. And, you know, from the get-go, we said, let's take the filters away. Unfiltered access to information that we can make available. And that's what we hope we've done.
So Ted, let me ask, so you guys are going through this and obviously there's some kind of institutional familiarity with all the stuff that you have in the archives, I imagine, but still, as you're going through this process, there had to be some point where you or one of your coworkers was looking at something and said, wait, what the hell is this? Right? Like, does anything stand out as like really shocking or even going through this whole process?
The accessories brochures are hilarious. I encourage anybody listening or watching, get on the site and just start and put in accessories because it'll blow you away. I mean, a Bronco radio was, I'm going from memory, like $38 or something like that. But it's an accessory in 1965. It doesn't come standard. And just to look at the prices and look at see what came standard versus what came as an accessory, whether it's a snowplow for a Bronco or whether it's white wall tower tires for a Mustang or we joked before we went on air about a Mustang pulling motorcycles or one of my favorite is a Mustang backing a boat into a dry dock. I mean, the accessories catalogs and then the freewheeling series. How can you not love California beach scenes with orange and brown? I mean, that just speaks to me, speaks to my heart, makes me come out. In a Pinto, guys. Pinto freewheeling. Yeah. It ought to go into the Smithsonian.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
You're giving me so many things to pull up right now. So hold on.
One story while you're doing that, though, is I gave a demonstration.
Go for it, man.
Internal employees, and we asked them to test the site for us. And one of them is a member, and he's an employee, but he's a member of a T-Bird Collectors Club. And he wrote me back, okay. He put tears in my eyes because I have access to stuff now that I could never get access to easily. And it's all in one place, and it's so easy to find. And I thought, that's what we do. That's why we're doing this site.
So, well, now you stole my anecdote as well. So I will share this real quick. So I write about cars every day. Of course, I also collect literature about cars. An eBay seller that I follow put up this brochure for the 1960 Thunderbird for, I believe, $12. And you gave us early access to the site. So I was looking around and I'm like, I wonder, do you have this brochure that this eBay seller is selling? And sure enough, it's right here. As you can see, it's in super high res. It looks super good.
You're not
good.
On screen right now. You may be.
Oh, you can't see it yet, Chris.
I'm a bad person. Okay, here we go.
No, but you were very descriptive, so I knew what you were talking about.
Well, here it is. 60 Thunderbird, the world's most wanted car. It's got a 60 Thunderbird convertible in yellow-ish on the front. It's got another one. Big columned house with the coupe. And there's, I actually shared this. Yeah. Brett, you'll remember I shared this last Thursday or Friday in our chat, and we were talking about how fascinating the number of colors available is. Like, yeah. you end up with colors like Palm Springs Rose, which is this very pinkish shade, but do you want the entire car to be that color? Do you want the car but the roof to be white? Do you want just the roof to be that color? And it's fascinating in that way. And in addition to that, you also have the interior colors. And again, as you were saying, they're so high res that you can easily see like just kind of the texture of the upholstery. And it's really cool. If you're an old car nerd, this is what you want.
This was the one, like, you know, there's like a lot of, you know, kind of us versus them in the car world where people who like old cars hate new cars and vice versa. And this is the one part where I really think that us versus them has a point, because every car today is gray or silver or black. And these are just like, I just can't imagine the manufacturing complexity of alone of having all these different options in 1960. And you just drive down the road and you've got a rainbow in front of you. It is so cool to see. Like, this is one of those moments that I was like, wow, yeah, they did some things really, really right 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
Can you imagine the industrial complexity involved with delivering the product like this?
No.
There's no computers yet, guys. I mean, punch cards are there, but there's no computers that are doing this. It's all, you know, hand annotated material going into the plant. It's insane. But keep in mind too, but this is the story about the Thunderbird. This is what the Thunderbird was, the king of the Ford cars. Mm-hmm. And you had to have specialness to set it apart. Otherwise, it's a souped up airline.
Yeah.
I love this stuff too. And this brochure is a really great example because of this, you know, the sort of swatches that we're looking at, swatches and colors, but you're starting with, and I know everybody geeks out about this, this is why people want to collect these things, right? But like a beautiful sort of hand-painted image, right? With the car superimposed on top of it. You're looking at like these kind of layouts that took like graphic designers and illustrators and craftspeople, you know, sort of artisans a long, long time, even before legal was concerned, to like pull it together and have something that was really beautiful and evocative of what the story is supposed to be around the model. So there's just so much craft going into the actual product that was scanned and here, put here too, that I think is, you know, people still do this, but like on such a small scale relative to what they had to do. How many of these Thunderbird catalogs or brochures, how many of these things were printed? You know, like hundreds of thousands, I imagine, right?
Yeah, it would have been hundreds of thousands. And I would argue with the Thunderbird being the most desirable car of that era, I would put the 61 Continental ahead of it, but that's just me arguing. But yes, hundreds of thousands. Although that, hey, go back and that roof mechanism.
Okay, yeah,
that was originally conceived for the Continental.
Oh, I believe that. Sure,
but then it was rejected, and then later reincorporated as a T-Bird design. But then the 61 T-Bird was actually a rejected Thunderbird design that they put coach doors on and made the hood longer and lower. So the cannibalism between the two sides, because the T-Bird people didn't love the Thunderbird people, and I'm sorry, the Continental people, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. The design teams duked it out. But look at the fonts and look at the colors and look at everything. It feels evocative of a different era, which is exactly what it's supposed to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that alone, I mean, Ted, you mentioned before sort of the idea of Mustangs or Pintos, oranges and golds and beach scenes and stuff. There's another, not to pivot away to a slightly less sexy area, but one of the things that I looked at first when I opened this up was, and this is really funny, it's so personal, right? But I have, I looked up Mercury Sable, right? Because I have a really strong memory of being probably a high school freshman or something like that. It was early 90s. And it was a year we were getting a new car. My dad hadn't gotten a new car in a long time. So he did the rounds to all the dealerships and he came back with a stack of all these catalogs for all the different models. And
maybe Seth. I'll pull it up for you.
It's 1992 is the one that I got.
1992. Okay.
1992 model year. I did that search and looked at all the covers, and immediately I saw the cover of that one and I was like transported back to my living room in 1991 or whenever, you know, late 92 or something like that. And it really, like, it's meaningful, right? That's a memory that you would never have had from your own life, right? Sitting there with my dad going through car catalogs. That now people, like, everybody think of these experiences times millions of people being able to visit the site and have, you know, these individual interactions with the content. I just think that's hard to quantify.
Right? I always say there's only a couple of things that we give nicknames to as humans. We nickname our kids, our pets, and our cars. And every once in a while, a sport, like a driver or a musical instrument, but not many things. And it's because we form an emotional bond with them. Our storytelling, which is why there are four journalists right now who write about cars for a living, because people form emotional bonds with them. So it's a powerful thing. And we felt that there was untapped potential in our collection for that. And Chris, I don't know if you're trying to share it, but it's not sharing at the moment.
Nope, it's still downloading. Like you said. So
And do warn your listeners. These brochures are big. They're heavy. We had a choice about making them slight, where you could blow them up and have blurry pictures, or making them heavy and you could blow them up and be able to see the detail. So either way.
I'm sharing it now. And you can, for anyone who is watching, I'm sharing it now. And you can see the bar filling up. They are very high resolution. So, but that's a good thing in my opinion. Yeah. Like you said, you have to balance speed with quality. And I think for anyone who is coming to this, they want the quality that, you know,
that was our
it takes a second. Yeah. But once you get it, it's just looks so good. And as you saw with me zooming in on other stuff, you can zoom in on just like individual letters practically, and it's there. And so, Seth, here is your Mercury Sable. 16 page.
Yeah. Although I've got to say, there's one other reason it's taking longer to download. It's that we made them handicap accessible as well. We optimized most of these brochures, not all of them. There's an occasional one or two that aren't done yet. So that those that are vision or hearing impaired can have alternative text or machine read to them. This is one of the ones that's done, and given the length of time it took to download, it may be one. All of the text that you're seeing on the screen, or for the listeners, that's appearing in the brochure, that'll be read to somebody who's very vision impaired. So we put a lot of effort into the work to make the brochure collection and the photograph collection entirely accessible to everyone, regardless of vision or hearing impairments.
That's
some steering wheel, isn't
it? Very cool.
Yeah.
I don't know if you blew by. There's a really good overhead view of an all red kind of velour interior of the car. I think it's the wagon, but I'm not sure.
Let's see if I can find that
Sable LS wagon. But I just
wagon. Oh, there it is.
That's incredible. First of all, I don't even know how to get that shot.
That's a great colorway.
They must have had a cutaway car or something. That's just incredible. again, like piece of photography there that just ends up here and tells a kind of crazy story. But yeah, it's very cool. We all gravitate to the cars that we had first experiences with and really loved. So stuff like this is red meat for children of the 90s like myself.
So can I talk about next steps for this site?
Absolutely. That's what I was about to ask you about. So perfect.
So we launched. It took a while. It was a labor of love. Our team is going to take a deep breath, and we have a meeting next week to talk about what's next. And the first thing that we believe that we're going to do is a library of concept vehicles. We have a photograph collection of concept vehicles that goes from essentially very strongly from 1955 all the way up until the 2000s. So whether you want a photo of a clay model of a Gyron in 1955, or you want the Rock Bronco concept from, what was that, 03? You know, we have all those images. So we're talking about creating out a concept library. Another one that we're doing is, we just finished, I got a status report today, we scanned 60,000 Ford of England images.
Wow. Yeah.
It's so every single car manufactured in England, all the way from the Model Ts that were assembled, you know, shipped in pieces and sub-assembled over there, to the every car, every British car. Motorsports is on the list. If you do a search under GT, Chris, it's sad. I think there's 8 pictures of GTs in there. we are still exploring the rights, because if a GT has a Golf logo, can I display it and have it downloadable? We're working with legal to discover that and to discover NASCAR. And then Ford locations around the world, Dagenham, the Rouge, Island Park, Willow Run, the things that people would expect to be in there. Those are the 4 big categories that we're looking at. And then the other big one is Ford Times Magazine. It's done. It's going through accessibility. Like I said, we expended a lot of energy to make them accessible. It's going through accessibility viewing right now. And so Ford Times, Concepts, Ford of England, Ford Buildings, and Motorsports at some point next year.
You told me earlier what Ford Times was, but just for the audience who might not know, can you tell them just a bit about what Ford Times is and what that means?
Brett, you're raising a hand. Do you know what it is?
I'm one of the audience members.
So if you bought a car from a Ford or Lincoln dealer, you either got Ford Times from a Ford dealer, or you got the Lincoln Continental from a Lincoln dealer. And for a while, it was a magazine with the second largest circulation in the world behind Reader's Digest. And every issue featured a travel section, a car review, and guess what kind of cars they reviewed? Fine artwork.
A lot of Chryslers, I bet.
Yeah. Stories. So, in April, they would get O.B. Keeler to do a story on Bobby Jones. And hidden in the corner would be a picture of Bobby Jones and his Model A he drove in 1930. But it was really a travelogue. It was the Ford Times. And every issue featured restaurants from around the country. So if there was a notable restaurant in your area, it might be featured in Ford Times. It's a wonderful resource to understand Americana and to understand. Ford is like second level on this. Americana is first level. One of my favorite stories is somebody who drove the entire route of Route 66 and then wrote about it and talked about, they were in a Ford, and that got mentioned once or twice, but there wasn't an overt Ford section. So Ford Times will be a wonderful addition for their artwork and the stories. And it was a who's who of writers and artists who contributed to the magazine.
And you told me earlier that it had, at least at one point, it had the second highest circulation behind Reader's magazine in America, behind Reader's Digest.
Same format, same size, small square, same format, same everything. And
perfect for your glove box.
I'm sorry?
Perfect for your glove box. Just throw it in the glove box.
But it was mailed to your house. And the deal, if you were in a different area, the different dealers might be featured on the back cover. Different ads would be in there. But if it was 55 pages, and most were 55 to 58, 50 of the 55 pages are on Americana and 5 are on Ford.
That's cool.
Restaurant reviews, road trip in Nantucket. In fact, with the Lincoln team, I explored earlier this year, reliving – a continental road trip through Nantucket in Continentals. Said, why don't we go back and redo this? We did it in 1958. This sounds like a cool idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, looking forward to all of that. That's really exciting. I mean, and obviously keeping you guys really busy too. So we appreciate the hard work for sure.
So of those categories, I'll put it out to a media vote. Which would you want first? They're all going to go in eventually. And I'll just tell you right now, we have 5,000 assets in 10 years. I hope we have 50,000. So actually in 5 years, it won't take us 10. It'll take us 5 years. We'll be at 50,000.
I'm torn personally between the concepts and the Ford of Britain stuff, because you and I have spoken, I've seen some of the concept stuff and those images are amazing, but also there's such Ford of Europe did some weird stuff back in the day and that's cool too. So I'm torn between those two. You, Brett, Seth, what do you want?
I did a story a few years ago for Truck Trend, when I worked for Truck Trend, and it was the 10 wackiest concept trucks in history. And one of those was the Power Stroke concept from 1992 or 93. Just this wild, super curvaceous dually that just looked very 1990s. So that's got me very interested in learning more about that, because there wasn't that much information publicly facing back in the day. But I got to say, four times, that sounds so cool. I would love to know what a travelogue was like in, you know, some of those. What years did you say that they were published?
18 to 1980.
Yeah, I would love to know what a 1942 travelogue felt like. That is so cool.
One of the things that has me worried about four times, and I'm getting into weeds, but every word in every one of these documents is searchable. So if you type in trailer and it's buried in a PDF, it's going to come back up as a search result. So four times might overtake the system if I put 70 years of word searchable documents. And so we're trying to see if we can do that one, but maybe wall it off a little bit. But Seth, what would you pick?
I mean, immediately I like the British stuff. I think is so cool. Like that, you know, Ford UK has always gotten, you know, at least I grew up thinking a lot about like Forbidden Fruit and escorts that I wouldn't ever be able to buy new or used and things like that. So I love that stuff. But I agree that I'm a magazine kid too. Like I really dig magazines, and I think like being able to sort of pick your way through decades of those would be really interesting. So
it's gonna be interesting.
I'm a little split.
We're going to be the goal is that this platform will be the one-stop shop for anything Ford related, and every single document, every single photo will be authentic, high resolution, and free. And, you know, if you use that as your North Star, you're not going to go wrong.
Absolutely not.
Regardless of what we put in there. Because if people don't search for it, that's fine. They don't find it. And if they don't want to see it or don't want to search a category, that's fine. We'll find other stuff. The main thing is just to be open and transparent and revolutionize the Ford archives.
Love it. It's great.
Well, here, real quick, Ted, I'm gonna let you go, but I do want to share this. We were talking about European Ford. So real quick, I pulled up. This is a European Ford that was available in the United States. This is the Ford Capri, which for anyone who doesn't know is kind of the best way I can describe it was
my first car.
Oh, really?
The 77 Capri Ghia.
That's a cool first car.
Yeah.
It was kind of the European version of the Mustang. It had kind of the same ethos as the Mustang, but you couldn't really do a V8 in Europe because kind of the taxes and stuff like that. But it was still this sporty two-door rear-wheel drive car, and they were available in the United States. And as you can see here, a Lincoln Mercury division. They were available from Lincoln Mercury division. Lincoln Mercury dealers, sorry, not regular Ford dealers. And I just love this German craftsmanship, Italian flair, and thrifty gas mileage, because you can tell this is from the 70s.
Well, you're not sharing if it's.
Oh, damn. Guys, I'm sorry. I am horrible at hosting.
Guess who else had one? Edsel Ford had one personally built for him.
Did he really?
It sold two or three. He told me the story too. He said, Dad told me he was going to get me something better than a Mustang. And it was the Capri.
Yeah.
My mom also had a Capri. She had a white Capri. I can't remember what year it was. And the sequence was different. She had a Mustang too, in what the color that I always describe as Caucasian. It was like it was a very sort of like creamy tan color.
Yeah.
That probably wouldn't fly today. And then she had a white Capri with a red top that I thought was really cool when I was a little kid. So
mine was red with a black top, and because it was German engineered, it had a map light on the passenger side. So the passenger could, it was this little thing that looked like a periscope, and you'd pull it out and it would light and it would illuminate maybe a 4-inch section of your map. But if you're driving in the dark, you've got your little map light to try to get you. Man, and the car would cook. It had a nice engine. It was sweet. Unfortunately, I was a teenage dolt and I treated it like rubbish and it turned into rubbish. But I've actually been looking for one. If I find one in the future, I will go back and rebuy one because it was fantastic.
If we see anything, we'll hit you up for sure.
Yeah. Well, Ted, thank you so much for joining us. FordHeritageVault.com is the website. If you are a Ford fan of any kind and you love Ford history, you got to check this out. There's just so much cool stuff there. And as you were saying, it's only going to get better. There's only more stuff that's going to come. It's cool. So thank you for joining us.
I've got to throw Motor One a bone too, because we only approached two media outlets early to give access to the site, and Motor One was one of the outlets. And it's because of the fantastic stuff that you guys write about. And I love the fact that whenever I tweet out a quirky photo, I usually get a reply from one of your reporters saying, "You got more on this?" The Turbo Thunderbird from 57, you know, is like, that's a cool piece. Let's do something. And that's the kind of value that we can unlock in the archives, and we can begin to share. And we can only share it because people like you take note and write about it.
Totally. Yeah. We love automotive history around here. I love, you know, the latest and greatest stuff is cool. In fact, we're going to be talking about that right after you sign off, but also the history of cars that, you know, the engineering things that maybe didn't quite work out, or the design things that were interesting, but you know, maybe people didn't buy, like, there's just so many interesting things about cars that make me love it and make me want to write about it every day. So,
perfect. Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yep. Ted, thank you. So thanks for joining us. So that was Ted Ryan from Ford. Again,
that was too cool. Could have talked to him for 3 hours. That was so cool.
Yeah, no, it's been real quick. I'll promote an earlier episode. I would have to look up what episode number it is. I'll put it in the post when I write it. But Ted also joined us when we were talking about the Ford Bronco, because obviously the new Bronco is back. But he joined us talking about the original Ford Bronco. He showed off a concept for a military version that they proposed to the U.S. government that didn't get adopted. He showed off the Pope Mobile version that was actually real, that when the Pope visited in sometime in the late 70s, I want to say it was 77 or 78, that Ford actually built, and that was the Pope Mobile for his the Pope's visit to the United States. Just good guy, lots of knowledge, cool stuff.
Yeah.
I
don't doubt that we'll have him back on the podcast other relevant topics, or just when you know, we want to have a fun conversation about some old stuff. And now we have awesome stuff to point to. Especially if we've downloaded the brochures ahead of time.
Yeah.
Right. But what a fun guy.
So, but let's transition. We talked about old cars. Let's talk about new cars, specifically new supercars, new hypercars. The McLaren Artura is kind of our hook for this segment. Seth, you were supposed to drive it. Things happen. The world happens. It's the way it goes, but we're still going to talk about a supercar. So let's start out. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, listen, so I was very excited. You know, I don't get to travel as much to drive as many cars as I did back in the day. So this was one that I was really looking forward to. McLaren had a program in Spain, for a first drive program. So kind of limited to a couple of outlets invited out to go and drive the car. And unfortunately my whole family came down with COVID, so I missed it. The silver lining here for the readers, and you're pulling it up here, is go to moto1.com, check out the story that we have. We're able to pick up a story from honestly one of my favorite writers in the business, who's not on staff here, Bassem Wassef. Amazing, did an amazing piece for us. really, really was able to shake the car down. I know even there they were having a little bit of logistical issues in the early going, but they were able to get the car on the track. And I think the good news is that whether it's me or some of us, we're going to get another chance to drive this car too later in the year. So we'll be able to come back and bring even more information and driving impressions too. So we're definitely not done with it, but yeah, what an exciting, I mean, listen, it's always fun to get into any McLaren and to get into one. I've done a couple of the first drive programs for, I think, you know, 570 GT. I did the Senna program, which was incredible. It's always like stepping out of reality and into this sort of like hyper version of reality when you're getting into a new McLaren product. So I can only imagine that this car makes you feel that way too. And is really, it really transports you. So we can go into the details if you guys want, but I don't know. I'm really interested as we continue to have this conversation, like where we're sort of drawing the line these days between a supercar and a hypercar. Brett, you pointed out, right? Like this is bread and butter McLaren lineup, despite the fact that it's got this kind of exotic hybridized powertrain. This is not a P1, right? This is not top of the line. This is kind of the new standard.
This sits between the McLaren GT and the 720S. It's not even close to the top of the lineup. And it's kind of weird that they're using this product to debut their new V6 engine, their new hybrid powertrain. Like it's a very cutting edge vehicle for being among McLarens, relatively attainable, relatively affordable. It's not a P1. It's not a Senna.
Yeah. What we're $260,000 or something on it, which as these things go is not, you know, you're only talking about a little bit more than a 911 turbo at that point. Right. Like, Yeah. Very, very cool. And a car that I would imagine if you live in a place like LA or Miami or, you know, Vegas or Rome or something, you're going to see these on the road. Right.
Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about this as Brett, you were the one that brought this up in our chat that kind of the Artura, this is not McLaren's halo car. Like there are McLarens that you can spend much more on, but it made me wonder, is the definition of what we call a supercar and a hypercar, are we kind of seeing that blending together again, that it's just kind of all one thing? Or do you still think that there is, you know, there is your run of the mill Corvette, let's say that, you know, someone who is wealthy can buy, but then the ultra rich end up with a McLaren, and then the super ultra rich, they end up with something like a Pagani or a Koenigsegg or something like that.
It's really hard because there aren't really clear boundaries anymore in terms of performance and numbers. Like a couple of weeks ago, Clint, our good friend at Motor One Video, had a Porsche 911 GTS. And he let me drive it for a couple days. And then they took the 911 GTS away and dropped off a 765 LT, which was a mental machine in every way. But when I sat down to look at, like, they dropped it off and I was terrified to drive it. And then I sat down and looked at the numbers. And 0 to 60 on the 765 LT is like 2.5 seconds. Stupid fast. But then I looked at the 911 GTS and it was 3 seconds. And I was like, That is not that big of a difference for a car that costs three times as much, you know? So you can't really draw these clear lines like you could 10 or 15 years ago by looking at performance numbers alone.
I have an idea. I did a tiny bit of homework before this, and I think I have a definition for a hypercar in 2022. Do you guys want to hear it? And you can agree or disagree?
I'd love to. Let's hear it.
All right. So minimum of $1 million. Like we're not talking about six figure car. I think if you're in a hypercar, you're a seven figure car these days, right? So there's our price barrier. And honestly, I think most of them are more like 2 or 3 million at this point. But I think that you've got to have either 1,000 horsepower or a super extreme power to weight ratio, right? So I think like Valkyrie is one that maybe we'll talk about that doesn't hit. Actually, sorry, Valkyrie does hit 1,000 horsepower, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was the other one? Was it the Pagani that we were talking about that maybe we're speculating might be under 1,000? Like some of them might only be 800 or 900. But the point is, like, if you've done a ton of work to lightweight the car, like I will accept an extreme sort of one kilogram to one metric horsepower or better power to weight ratio as a stand in for 1,000 horsepower. Right. zero to 60 time has got to be under 3 seconds for sure. And probably it's closer to two than it is to three. Right. So somewhere in the middle. Exotic powertrain, not typically, I don't think, maybe you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think that there are a lot of these that just do make power one way. I think most of them are hybridized at some point. So typically a combination of power plants. And then you've got to have other like full, very large scale exotic materials, lightweighting mm-hmm. the car, carbon fiber wheels, obviously like carbon fiber structure, like all that stuff. So honestly, I think if you look at the list of things that maybe we would all agree on fit into the hypercar definition, those are all super high standards. Like Brett, to your point, like 10 years ago, that would have been an insane list that no one car can hit. And now I think that there are like five or six or seven cars that can hit a lot of those that are either out or, you know, like in production, or we're going to see them soon. So,
mm-hmm. Well, and again, it's not even like, that's a great list and I totally agree. And there are even cars that break those rules. Like I'm right. thinking of the, right now, the Gordon Murray T50,
right.
is naturally aspirated. It has 650 some odd horsepower, like not that much power, all things considered.
But it's got a fan on the back sucking it to the road.
But it's got a fan on the back sucking it to the road. It costs $2.5 million. It's made out of adamantium and yeah. titanium. Like it's made out of nothing that you've ever seen on a car before. Like it mm-hmm. does. It takes all of those boxes while still only having 650 horsepower or whatever. Like it's. We just live in such a mental world of cars right now.
I think any of those things are on a sliding scale, right? Again, so like if you dial your power way up, maybe you can dial your price way down, right? I doubt that would happen, but like you don't necessarily have to hit all of them if you're kind of over indexing on other things that are really important. But
you're building your dream car using hit points like in a right. In a video
exactly,
game.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's min maxing. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And so I'm going to pull this up here. So one of the other outliers you were just talking about is that it is going to hit that price point. It is going to be under 1,000 horsepower, though. And that is the Pagani C10, which they're saying is only going to have around 800 horsepower, but it is going to be even less weight than the current Huayra. Is that how you say it?
Huayra?
Huayra. Am I saying that wrong?
No. Yeah. Huayra, as if it were wire, W-I-R-E.
Oh, so the H is silent. Okay.
Huayra.
The current Huayra. So less weight, more power. But we know it's going to cost. We don't know what it's going to cost, but I can certainly assume $1.5 million, $2 million, something like that, to own one of these. And it's still, we're only seeing teasers of it so far. It's going to use a Mercedes AMG sourced V12. Just a very cool car. But according to Horatio Pagani, the goal is we're going to cut weight, but we're going to leave power roughly the same. It's going to have 20 or 30 more horsepower, but an interesting beast, I think.
I'm just like, so I've never been behind the wheel of a Pagani at all. I've seen them at auto shows. I've seen yep. them, in real life on the street, but not moving right at an event. I think these cars are absolutely incredible. I think from multiple stories that I've read and interviews that I've watched or listened to with Horatio, I think that he just looks at the world a little bit differently, like mm-hmm. in a very genius way. Like he can sort of see, where I see three colors, he sees a universe, right? Yeah. Like I just think that he's one of those guys. And this car is going to be really exciting because Huayra, honestly, when Huayra came out, it was a mind-bending car for me. The way that it looked, the way that it was finished, even stuff on, seriously, guys, like the Pagani stuff, like Pagani interiors look like they're designed by genius-level Italian interior designers from the 1960s or something like that. Like, it really is kind of incredible stuff. So as this one rolls out, we're looking at spy shots right now. And I think even in this article, we kind of call out that the car looks a little tame. Partially yep. because of the way that it's presented and it's not in its full form and right color and stuff. Like I'm incredibly convinced that this will be another show stopping real true hypercar from Pagani.
Totally.
Form. So
totally
super excited for this one.
And they've already confirmed. So we're looking at, if you're watching on YouTube, we're looking at a coupe version here. They've already confirmed that there's going to be a convertible or an open top or, you know, removable roof, or however you want to say it, and also a track version. So, you know, it's going to come initially as one vehicle, and then they're going to iterate on that into several other vehicles.
Yeah. Can I just say, is anybody else, I know you guys talk, usually I'm on the other side of this, like the alphanumeric versus name debate, but mm-hmm. with Pagani especially, like they had a Zonda and a Huayra. They had two really evocative names and cool cars. Do we really think that they're going to end up calling this C10? I mean, that sounds like a paper.
Because they called the Zonda the C12. They've done code names before. So no, this is going to have some that crap, insane, like mythological. The Huayra is like a mythological Incan god, I think. It's something like that. Like, so okay. they're going to go into the history books for the C10.
But yeah, so I was referencing Wikipedia earlier. I had to just do something quick here. So if they're wrong, they're wrong, but I don't think they're wrong. I'm pretty sure this is actually accurate. But yeah, the original versions of the Zonda were called the C12. So we're seeing.
Excuse me. Yeah. All right. Right. Good.
There. So yeah. So there is a history of them using kind of an alphanumeric initially and then giving their vehicles a name. So I don't think it's just going to be the C10.
Internal.
And before I get flamed, it was actually a Quechua god, not an Incan god. So my bad.
That's right.
We are nothing if not vigilant and fact-checking everything here at Rambling About Cars.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But we were talking about the Artura, and I kind of wanted to bring that into kind of the two supercars that have debuted. I guess the production versions of the two supercars, I should say, debuted this year, which is the Aston Martin Valkyrie and the Mercedes AMG One. I'm going to start with the One here simply because that's the one that has debuted more recently. And it's an interesting time if you are a super rich person wanting to spend a lot of money on a supercar with a relationship to Formula One, because kind of both of these cars do that in some size, shape, or form. The Mercedes AMG One, you get a engine derived from Formula One. With the Aston Martin Valkyrie, you get a designed by Adrian Newey of Red Bull Racing, who has designed some of the most winning, best cars of this era of Formula One. So, yeah.
Just incredibly cool, right? There's another one, too, that just to throw it out there. So there's Valkyrie, there's AMG One or Project One. Another one that we've seen recently that kind of fits this mold is the Jeff Perez wrote. We had some stories on it. The company's called Delage, right? It's brought back a sort of like historic French mark for the supercar, and it's another thing like this. It's almost like an F1 car, an F1 style car that's got fenders on it, right? That's got a little bit more body to it, but using that same super racy technology. I don't know, you guys. Like, I've seen some of the videos of Valkyrie and seen some of these in motion. I have a feeling these cars are just going to be absolutely astonishing to drive when and if we do have those opportunities.
Yeah, I hope. I know as the news writer of the crew, I'm not going to get that opportunity, but I hope one of you two get the opportunity to drive a Valkyrie or an AMG One, because they sound, especially in the case of the Valkyrie, they sound amazing. Like, they sound like some of the best road cars we've ever heard, is the best way I can say it. So I hope you
kind
guys
of an interesting
get to get
thing. Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, I was done. Go for it.
I was just going to say, kind of an interesting thing about all of these vehicles, the Delage D12, the Aston Martin Valkyrie, and the AMG One, is they all are electrified now. Like, we're living in a world where electrification is no longer the purview of economy cars. This is like a legitimate performance booster, you know? Again, taking technology from Formula One that's been using electrification in some ways for years now. So we're kind of like witnessing this about face where hybrid is no longer a dirty word among auto enthusiasts.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that idea has existed around the edges for a while. Like, again, it's awesome to see it kind of trickling down, as you would, you know, we started this talking about Artura, and it, and it's cool to see it extending. NSX is another great example, right? Current NSX mm-hmm. is another awesome example where you've got like a really impressive performance car that's got hybridization as a performance tool and not as an economy tool, right? Corvette is coming out with this as well. Like, this is something that's going to be really standard. And it's also a really convenient way to kind of bridge where we are right now with these like hardcore enthusiast vehicles and where we're going of everything being like purely electric, because we know that we can see the performance advantage and the future of that performance advantage with like full electrification too, right? That's the exciting story for McLaren, that this is, I mean, it's cool. What we have now is cool, and living in the moment is a good thing, but it also is pointing, the arrow is pointing up for like full electrification and the ramifications on super sports cars, super performance cars. So it is, in a way, I've read a lot of this and had a lot of these thoughts, like we are enjoying the best kind of apogee of ICE technology and internal combustion performance cars probably right now through the next 5 years. And we're getting to see the birth of like all of this completely new stuff, which is super exciting. I'm fascinated with it.
Yeah. And it just makes me think, just organically here, Brett and Seth also in our chat, we've thought about the ways that having a purely electric vehicle could end up affecting the design of any vehicle. That the fact that you don't have to have a hood and an engine under there and a transmission tunnel, that it's going to end up freeing up designers to create vehicles that could look vastly different than what we see today because of the differences, that electric motors are much smaller, that, you know, you don't need the traditional hood. Maybe you put a frunk there. Maybe you put some sort of aggressive arch there or angle or something like that. You're still going to have that front axle, but you don't need an engine in front of it to power it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, go back to like, you know, Colin Chapman and building race cars in the 60s, right? Like, reducing mm-hmm. frontal area is a huge, huge performance, has the opportunity to be a huge performance booster, right? So not to mention like the aero advantages that you have when you don't have like a block of an engine in front that you're kind of fighting or sculpting around so mm-hmm. that the wind does what you want it to do. Like, I think that we're only just scratching the surface of what designers are capable of with this kind mm-hmm. of technology. And that's even before we've started radically thinking about forming, you know, listen, I remember being at MIT, this was already years ago, like MIT and Lamborghini were working on a program together where they were talking about using essentially nanotubes, like carbon nanotubes, to both store energy and be structural, right? So the theory is there could be a Lamborghini in the next 10 years where the body panels are the battery. Right. And so they're structural. Imagine the possibilities there. The car can be shaped like whatever you want, whatever you need it to do, when suddenly form and function are literally being like sort of forged together into one, one piece, one big element of the car. Like I said, it's the next 10 years, the next 20 years are going to be, especially in this space where it's a luxury good or it's a toy for billionaires or it's a racing thing and not in the what we are all going to be doing, how we're going to be getting to work and getting our kids to school and stuff. In that space, the innovation is just going to be bananas. Sure. I mean, it's fascinating.
I mean, I kind of think you hit an interesting point there, because the delta between what supercars can do now and what supercars are going to be able to do in 10 or 15 years, it's probably not that big. Like, modern supercars are amazing. They're already mid-engine, so you don't have to worry about the shape of the front end. Like, you can kind of, like, shape the car exactly how you want it. Like, a Lotus Evija, for example, is a fully electric supercar in theory, and it looks very similar to Inform to some of these others. However, with like commodity cars, these kind of vehicles that we're going to be driving our kids to school in, the difference between a modern crossover and a crossover, all electric crossover 15 years from now, is probably going to be huge. I mean, like, and it's because of this trickle down technology that we see in cars like NSX, Artura, like these play toys that are just printing money for some of these engineering firms. That's the reason why we're going to be able to see such incredible exponential growth in our commodity vehicles as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's perfectly said, because it's exactly what I was thinking of. And that is the fact that these things do end up trickling down eventually. That the, as you were saying that, I was thinking of the Toyota Corolla GR, the Circuit Edition, that has a forged carbon fiber roof that, mm-hmm. you know, even 20 years ago, forged carbon fiber, that was in the realm of supercars or hypercars. No one could own a, you know, no normal person, put it this way, I could not own a car with a forged carbon fiber piece. But now, you know, you can go out and buy a Toyota Corolla even, that has that is taking advantage of that technology. And so if you extrapolate from that and you see what these hypercars are doing today, that eventually that technology is going to trickle down and it's going to be available to the normal person, because these $1, $2 even more $1 million cars, that those are the playthings of the ultra rich. But it takes that in order for that technology to have a, you know, to have an economy of scale that a normal person can have access to it.
Yeah, well, especially, you're right. Like, especially I'm a little bit more skeptical, I guess, on the idea that there's this tech transfer that car companies love to talk about, especially if they go racing, right? They love to say, well, we're spending billions of dollars on our racing program, but that's going to make it into your F-150 in a way that maybe is a little not completely clear right now. And maybe it's just like a trim bit or something. I don't mean to be completely cynical, but when you're talking about real material science, where yeah, they're having, we've learned a lot about working with carbon fiber and making it a lot more affordable to use, and it's a lightweight material that's super strong, and there are tons of applications when you can get the cost down, right? Like, again,
right,
same deal with battery tech. I think, like, as that evolves, like, it's going to get better and better for cars that are cheaper and cheaper, and that's great for the majority of us, right? Mm-hmm. I do think that exists.
My argument, or my conversation I would have with that, is that think about in the 1980s when Formula One started using carbon fiber, that was just like the cutting edge of materials. And now something like a GMC Sierra has a carbon fiber bed. You know, that eventually that material has trickled down. It had to start somewhere. Sure. Someone out there had to be able to spend that money to have that material, and then slowly over the decades it has become something that, you know, a normal person could purchase, that it's available and it's out there. So,
and yeah, the money that they're spending on inboard suspensions and anti-lag devices and stuff like that, probably, you know, to your point, Seth, it's probably not going to ever show up in a commodity vehicle, quite frankly. Okay. But, you know, I would argue that with supercars more than with racing, I think supercar technology is what we're probably going to see proliferate, especially with advanced materials and like battery chemistry. I think that's where the big money is right now, and I think that's probably where we're going to see Mercedes-Benz, for example. You know, they have kind of an advanced battery chemistry in the EQXX, and they anticipate that as they produce more vehicles like the EQXX, they're going to be able to bring the economies of scale down, so that your C-Class electric in a couple of years has this weird air-cooled battery that's more efficient and longer lasting and everything like that.
Yeah, I'm even remembering, God, well, I'm half remembering because I don't remember the name. Mercedes built one of their first battery electric, it wasn't a demonstrator. They actually built a few of them. Like, they had press drives, I think, that they sold them, but they might have sold 10 of them. This was an electric car. It was not an
B-Class.
Yeah. No. This was like an exotic, like, it was an existing, platform that
the
SLS. Exactly. Thank you. SLS AMG electric drive, right? That car was pretty mind-blowing.
You and I are on this.
when it debuted, and you look at it now, and it feels like a horse in a buggy compared to a Model S or something like that. I think it had under 100 miles of range, and it was really impressive, but you'd actually get 30 miles of range out of it when it was somebody like from the enthusiast media driving it hard or something like that. We've come a really long way with all that stuff in a short span of time. So it is exciting to kind of rocket that forward. But Brett, I also thought your point was interesting too, about, like, I mean, supercars are so capable right now, and they could get more capable, but you do reach at some point, you're going to reach like the outer limits of what a human driver can endure to, right? You can only make a car so fast without crushing your chest with G-forces. So,
I mean, 15 years ago, the fastest Ferrari on the market, maybe 20 years ago, we'll say, Ferrari Enzo, 0 to 60 in 3.3 seconds. At the same time, in the same era, an F1 car could do 0 to 60 in 1.5 or 1.6. Nowadays, yeah. The F1 car can still go that fast, but supercars have closed the gap so much more. Like, exactly yeah. like you said, a human body can just not cannot withstand, you know, like your ribs can only contain so much before your organ starts sluicing through them at 5 or 6 G's, you know, like it's we've approached the limit, I think. And maybe I'm wrong. I would love to be wrong. It'd be great if we could get a car in the tenths of a second range for 0 to 60, but I don't see it happening. But anyway.
God, let's get that paint job back. Bruce is showing for the listeners, Bruce is showing the SLS yep. AMG electric drive in what can only yep. be described as like Tron blue. They made a green too, I believe. I believe there was kind of like this same metallic, like electric green, neon green.
That's got to be a wrap though, right? Could they paint something that lustrous and chromey?
It looks, yeah.
In 2012, I don't know, man.
Let's ask.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it time to ask if we can get one of these out of mothballs and do a new story on it?
Let's do
it. It's been 10 years. Is the answer. So
let's arrange the AMG one and the SLS AMG electric drive.
Totally.
I love it. I love it.
But yeah, so for anyone watching on YouTube, I should say this is from September 27th of 2012. Adrian Padnell, who still works with Motor One and is still the Batman of our site. Each electric motor only weighed 100 pounds and it had 740 horsepower. There's no mention of range in this story that he did back then. It probably came out later on. And it had a price tag of 416,500 euros in 2012 dollars.
Nothing. That's nothing today. See?
Exactly.
So far.
Well, folks, I think that's going to be our show for tonight. As always, thank you. Thank you, Ted, for joining us. You've been gone now for a bit, but thank you, Ted, for joining us. Seth Miersma, thank you very much for joining us. Brett T. Evans, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a great show. Chris Smith will be back next week. So
allegedly.
Look forward to that. Allegedly, yes. Who knows what could happen. But do you guys have anything that you want to promote? Any of your own personal social media? Anything you've recently written that you want to promote? Just anything. Go for it, guys. We got a second.
Brett,
nothing. Okay,
I've got. Yeah, I mean, listen, we're doing a new series. I just was working on the second version of it today, where it's super simple. It's a mini interview series called Five Questions. I've been reaching out to a lot of folks that I know in the automotive industry. You're going to see some people who are like, the first one was with Johnny Lieberman, who, as everybody here knows, I'm sure, like one of the most famous car journalists in the world. We're asking questions about what people are working on. Kind of the origin story, how they got into car stuff, and it's just a really mm-hmm. lightweight, fun thing. So I've got a bunch of those cooking in the pipeline. Check those out. We're trying to publish those on Thursdays. It looks like I know one will be up
Friday.
Tomorrow.
I thought it was Friday.
Maybe it was. I don't know. I should be better at this. It'll be an end of the week thing too. So take a look. There are a bunch of those in the can, and I'm excited to have people check them out. So.
Those are great. That's like the perfect lunch read, you know, like I really enjoyed, I read the manuscript for the one that you just shared that will be coming out next. I really enjoyed the Johnny Lieberman, and they're great. Just kind of, this is a person that I know of. This is a person that I've heard about, and this is how they tick. It's just really, really easy, snacky content, which is nice.
Should be fun.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited to publish the first drive of the Bronco Raptor, which is coming up in a few days.
Ooh.
So that will be a good one. Be sure to watch Motor One channel, Motor One website for that. That was a pretty, actually I can't say anything about it, so just go read the article and you'll enjoy it.
Yep. And then we also put up a video, Brett, that you shared with us of the F-150 Raptor R, and I know you can't really say anything about it, but you were able to share that video, and we put up a story about it. So
I don't know anything about it whatsoever. They literally were like, hey guys, if you turn around, you might see something interesting. And they drove the car past. So I literally was like fumbling with my phone to like take that 13 second, utterly crappy video that you'll see on the Motor One channel. But yep, you can definitely hear that there is something other than a turbocharged V6 under the hood. It's probably force inducted. It's probably a V8. I don't know anything else. Anything else is pure speculation at this point.
All right. Then, Seth, since you don't want to promote it, I want to promote your Friday show that we've been doing at MotorOne.com. Yeah. And that is, so it was originally on Twitter. It is now basically on everything, right? It's on Twitch and Facebook. Am I wrong
there? Yeah, not Twitch, right? So it's like this. It's kind of a podcast format. Yeah, we're calling it Test Car Happy Hour on Fridays at 4. Yep. A lot of the, you know, actually, it's good. It should be open to anybody. But right now, we've been doing editors who are driving press cars. Mm-hmm. I was just finding, like, you know, we're all virtual. We're all DMing each other all the time, and we're not having as many conversations as I'm used to having when we were kind of back in the office, quote unquote. So it's a way for us to get together and just chat about what we've been driving that week. It's pretty short, a half an hour. It's loose. And yeah, we are broadcasting it kind of the same way. So you can find it on YouTube, but you can also find it on, we'll put a post up on the site. You can find it on YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter. And the cool thing about it is, because that one's a live one using the same streaming platform that we have, ask your questions if you have them on any one of those platforms, and they all get sort of automatically directed to us so we can talk to y'all in real time, which is fun.
Totally. So yeah, so I am usually working while that show is going on. I haven't. No, that's just the truth. But yeah. But yeah, those guys are cool. I've watched one of the ones that were on Twitter back two weeks ago or so. And yeah, you get to ask questions. They drive, you know, they get press cars every week. And if you are curious about what they're driving, you get to ask questions about those cars, and they're going to answer it for you. So it's fun. It's a bit different, you know. Chris Smith and I, we talk about news, we talk to cool people, it's that type of thing, but we don't get press cars, and they do. So it's just, you know, two different things, but two very cool things. So yeah, join them on Friday, ask them questions, ask them about what they're driving. They'll give you your opinions. It's, yeah, fun stuff.
Ultimately, Motor One will be nothing but a series of podcasts.
That's not necessarily a bad thing. So... But yeah, thank you to everyone. Good afternoon, good evening, or good night. I hope I was as good as a main host as Chris Smith usually is. As I'm thinking about it in my brain, I don't think I am, but I hope I was. But Smith will be back next week, and we'll be talking some news. And hopefully, Seth met some cool people, a week or two ago, and we might have them on as guests soon. So I'm looking forward to that if that ends up panning out. So yeah. Thank you, everybody, and good night, and bye-bye.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
By law, 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors. The difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Learn why at Schwabvious.com.
Think advertising on TikTok isn't for your business? Think again.
With TikTok ads, we went from 250,000 downloads to over 1 million downloads in less than a year.
I'm Eve. I'm Anam, and we're the co-founders of Alinea.
Alinea Invest is an investing app for Gen Z.
We run 50 new ads per week with 3 variations thanks to TikTok Smart Plus campaigns. If you're not advertising on TikTok, you're missing out.
Drive more app downloads only on TikTok. Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.